Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the January 17, 2016 session, focusing on John chapter 2, the first 11 verses, Signs of Abundance. I'm David Cassidy, and I'm joined for this episode by our good friends Daniel Glaze and Bert Montgomery, and we're also pleased to welcome back Aaron Robinson Hall and Darian Duckworth. How are you guys doing?
Great.
Great.
Doing good, David.
Good to see you.
Good to be back with you.
Good. Well, before we get started tonight, I wanted to just offer a word about Faith Element. Now, this is obviously the Faith Element podcast, so I presume our listeners know something about us. But it may be, that some people simply know about us through the podcast. I wanted to just offer, a little bit of history. 2016 actually marks the beginning of our 8th year. Unbelievable, 8 years. But we're really excited about what's ahead. We started Faith Element in part because we were convinced that the new media tools that were appearing, the web, videos, music, photos, social media, all these new ways of communicating, that they were all wonderful vehicles for helping people connect with each other, but also with the insights of the scriptures. And we wondered what would happen if we took these new tools and tried to use them and enable people to use them in Bible study and in reflection with one another around the themes of the text. So if your Bible study group hasn't yet tried our premium Faith Element subscription, I hope you'll give it a try. Each week, it offers 5 unique and creative ways for your group to grapple with the text for the week. And it also offers Nikki's full Bible background video. We have videos and links to clips, music, and more that are in the sessions. So anyway, if you want to give it a try, enter the code PODCAST when you sign up for premium, and you'll get 75% off your first month. So really low risk. We hope you'll give it a try and see all the things that we're working on here at Faith Element. So with that good word, Bert, can you give us an introduction to this interesting and well-known text for today?
Sure, I could try. Having grown up Baptist, and by the way, I'm still Baptist, this is one of the stories from John chapter 2, 1 through 11. This is one of those stories we Baptists wish we could delete from the Bible, or at least rewrite it. It's rather uncomfortable for us to admit that Jesus turned water into... Jesus turned water into... wine. And whether the Baptists like it or not, it really was actual wine, as in the great Tom Paxton folk song, Bottle of Wine, Fruit of the Vine, When You Gonna Let Me Get Sober? Now, Jesus did not choose to do this so much as it was kind of pushed on him. He's at this wedding with his mother, and the host runs out of wine. And this is Jesus' first recorded miracle in John's gospel. But it's obvious that Mary knows Jesus has a gift, because she just walks over to Jesus and says, "Son, they've run out of wine," wink, wink. And you get the feeling she's seen Jesus do some strange magical things before. And Jesus hems and haws. "Woman," he cries, but Mary, like all mothers, knows her son will not disappoint her, no matter how loudly he fusses. She turns to the servants and she says, "Y'all just do whatever he tells you to do." And Jesus sees these huge water jars that could each hold between 20 and 30 gallons, and he tells the servants, "Go fill them all with water." And after they've done this, you know this had to take some time, Jesus tells the servants to dip some out and take a glass to the host, the man in charge. And somewhere in this process, either as the servants pour the water into the jars, as the water sits in the jars, as the servants dip the water out of the jars, or maybe even as the water passes the man's lips, but somewhere in this, the water becomes wine. And this fact is noticed, of course, by the host, and he declares it to be great wine indeed. And he can't understand, because most party givers put out a little bit of good wine on the front end, and then the guests begin to get a little bit tipsy, and the party goers put out nothing but the cheap stuff. But here the host declares the best wine was saved for last, and there's an abundance of it. Never ending. There's plenty of it for everybody. So I'm convinced there's more to the story than simply Jesus' first miracle, which is what the Baptists always focus on. It's just his first miracle. And it's not actually something Jesus seemed to be focused on for his big first miracle. And I can't speak for everybody, and I'm certainly not a biblical scholar, but it seems to me that Jesus is giving his blessing to this, well, let's call it what it is, a party. And if I may quote the great contemporary mystic Kuhl and his gang, it's a celebration. So here's to God and here's to joy. And for my listeners, I'm lifting my glass of water.
Speaking of celebration, I love the fact that Methodists and Baptists have come together to talk about the story of water being turned into wine. Or
I know.
It's historic.
Because how many jokes have I heard from both churchgoers and non-churchgoers about the difference between a Methodist and a Baptist that somehow relates back to wine and somehow relates back to the story? Mm-hmm. So I was so excited when I heard that this was the text that we would be discussing. This is indeed a celebration, Bert.
I would just like to point out to listeners at home that being from New Orleans and being a Baptist preacher, I'm wearing a Bourbon Street cap as we're talking about this.
Awesome.
I felt it was appropriate.
Representing Elijah Craig. Good job. I just love that you put y'all in the gospel.
Thank you.
She said, y'all just do what he said. That sounds like my grandmother. But my grandmother also said Jesus never drank that wine now. He just made it.
Of course,
but I think we know better.
Of course, he drank Welch's grape juice, which was
Welch's grape juice
by a Methodist. So
any biblical Greek scholar can tell you that's really what it meant.
Yeah,
was grape juice.
Yeah, tell us about that great Methodist tradition of Welch's.
I don't remember the dates exactly, but this guy, I think it was Thomas Welch, is credited with coming up with this idea of non-fermented grape juice because of all that was going on about drinking at the time. And he felt like they didn't need to have wine in the church. And so he found a way to make this. And his son, who was also a dentist, which I find that funny that they were both dentists, who on the side had a business of taking the wine out of the church. But his son is actually the one that marketed it. And interestingly enough, he marketed it as wine, even though it was grape juice. And it took off from there. Churches began to say, hey, we need the non-alcoholic stuff. And so there was a market for Welch's grape juice. So you can thank the Methodists for what Jesus really drank. I guess would that make Jesus a Methodist then, if he turned it into Welch's grape juice?
Well, just as a side note, it was a Baptist in Kentucky who invented bourbon.
There you go.
That's right. You mentioned Elijah Craig.
Elijah Craig. We stepped it up from wine to bourbon.
I love that, Darian. The things that are obvious in this story, you know, the Baptist and the Methodist discussing it. And here you have a Jewish mother telling her son what to do. I mean, you know, the things that really don't even bear pointing out, but are there nonetheless.
Let's just get all the cliches here together. Well, speaking of the mother's role here, you know, I can imagine being in that moment, realizing that the wine is gone, the panic. I mean, you all have planned parties or been to, I know, David, you got some weddings coming up. Can you imagine in the planning of this party, realizing that you didn't have enough? I mean, just the stress of that.
I'm stressed out just when we have guests over. Because I love to grill. I have a big green egg smoker and I kind of obsess over it. But Regina always like, why did you buy so much at the store? I was like, I don't want to run out. You know, I mean, it would be the worst possible thing that could happen would be to run out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm a Southerner. I think most of us are Southerners. You always have more than you need. And, you know, planning Thanksgiving or Christmas with my mom, you know, we run through who's going to bring what. And anytime I have said, you know, let's just keep it simple. Simple? What? And so she, everybody has to have more than you need, plus leftovers, plus the next day's leftovers.
Granted, here in the South, it is about excess. But, you know, on a positive side, you know, we want our guests to feel like we've prepared for them. We want folks to feel like we're ready for them and we've prepared for them and we've made certain arrangements. And so running out is not just the social faux pas. It's, you know, it's did we really expect and prepare for these loved ones?
Have you guys ever been in a moment where you did run out, where you didn't have enough? Maybe a party, maybe. I mean, what does that feel like?
Being a pastor's kid, I was always at the back of the line at church just in case there wasn't enough chicken. I mean, you know, I can remember, you know, at the Wednesday night service, after the amen, before I could move a muscle, I felt the hand on my shoulder, and I knew whose it was. It was my father, so I often joke, you know, I'm a pastor and a pastor's kid. I've never been at the front of the line, and it was because it was, I mean, in a very real way, it was, if for whatever reason we have run out, you know, we're gonna hang back here.
And you're the one who can take the hit. You're the pastor's kid. Oh, it's yeah. Okay if you don't get yeah. your chicken.
That's right. That's right. If anybody was going to miss chicken that night, it was going to be me, my siblings, and yeah. But I don't know that I've been a part of where it's actually run out. Any of
at my 20 when I turned 21, my roommate at my college roommate at the time also turned 21, like within the same week. So we had a party for our friends who were only the friends that were 21 or older, and we ran out of beer, and we only bought like 2 6-packs because we knew nothing about how much people drank, because neither of us drank until we turned 21. So we ran out of beer. So it was the worst party ever because, it was a great party because we had a great time, but people came and there was no beer. So they left. And anyway, we learned after that that you need more than 2 6-packs. And I think we had one bottle of wine, maybe. But no, we were totally clueless. So yeah, ran out.
Okay, but that great life lesson there at your 21st birthday. I mean, that's kind of what I was getting at with my question. Why are we afraid of running out? What happens? What does that feel like when you run out? Well, people left. And so,
yeah.
You know, you feel like if you don't have enough, if you don't have the exact measured amount that you need for this thing, that people are going to leave, or the moment that you've hoped for is not going to happen. My story of running out, actually, we didn't run out, but a recent event at a church that shall remain nameless, lovely, wonderful people, but I was a part of a group planning a gathering for our denomination. Community event, lots of churches getting together. And when you have lots of churches getting together, you have a lot of hostess types getting together. And so in my planning, my idea was we supply chicken, everything else is covered dish. I know covered dish, we're Southerners. I knew there would be enough. Like, I kept assuring these hostess friends, there will be enough, I promise you. And the laying out of the food, the rearranging of the food on the table to make sure that there was still some tucked away for latecomer. I mean, it was just a whole tremendous hullabaloo. And in the end, we had more than enough. But the worry, the thought that, okay, what if people leave hungry? I think that goes to, well, the Southern hostess kind of feel, but also like, we don't want there to be this moment where we feel like we're missing something or lacking something.
Well, and if you've ever been at a, you know, at such an event and been the one toward the back of the line, Daniel, where it was really sparse and maybe there's a few other people and you just get the teeniest amount possible. I mean, it's awkward. You feel bad for the host. But for yourself too, right? I mean, you don't want your guests to feel like there's not enough for them. It's almost like saying there's not a place for you. There's not room for you.
But in this text, I don't feel like Jesus is the stressed out hostess. I feel like Jesus is pretty chill, not phased at all that there's no more wine.
And I absolutely love this interaction, but with him and Mary. I guess it's because we don't see just a whole lot of Mary in the scriptures, and here she is with her adult son, and there's this whole thing about, you know, how did this conversation take place? I love how Bert presented it in his introduction with the wink, wink. Was he feeling rushed? Was he feeling pressured? But was Mary trying to make him do something he didn't want to do just yet? Or did she, being his mother and being discerning, realize, hey, he's got what it takes, and that this is the time, that this is the time for him to step forward? And she wanted to nudge him in that direction. So I just love being able to use the imagination here of how this interaction between mother and son took place. And in a lot of ways, it's, even though he's an adult, this being his first quote unquote miracle of, according to John, it's like she's pushing him forward into his ministry, and it's the beginning of something new for him. I'd be curious to hear more about if you guys have any takes on how this conversation played out, and and exactly how that might have been between Jesus and Mary.
Well, you know, it's interesting as I read the story. Y'all correct me if I'm wrong. We don't have a part in the story where they sort of come to an understanding. Like Mary says, "Can you do this?" And he says, "Oh, all right." And then, I mean, it's sort of, he says, "No, I'm not going to do it yet." And then she says, she sort of sets it up, speaking to the servants, "All right, do whatever he's going to tell you to do." I mean, it's, she sort of, I don't know. It's almost like she doesn't even listen to his argument back. I mean, I don't know how this took place. Was it, listen, young man, you know, did she count backwards? Did she do 3, 2, you know, get over there and right. Fill it up? I don't know. I read it the way you did, Bert, you know, that she's been with him. She knows some of his identity and knows part of why he came into the world in the first place, and says, I think, Jesus, here's an opportunity to do something really special. And I guess he responds, you know, it's just not the right time. And she says, you know, I think it is. And speaks to the servants, goes ahead and sort of lays it out, says, do whatever he tells you to do. And he proceeds to follow through with it. I don't know. That's the way I read it. But, it is interesting to imagine the conversation, isn't it?
It is, and as a son, it's always fascinating to think about telling your mother, replying when your mother asks you to do something, saying, "Woman, what is that to you and to me?" I've always wanted to say that to my mom, and I never did.
Yeah, try that out, Bert. Let me know how that goes.
Yeah, that's not going to end well for you. But the idea that she was nudging him, you know, Darian said a mother's nudge. We know what a mother's nudge sounds like and feels like. And maybe she did count to 3, like he was 2 again. But, you know, you mentioned waiting. Does a miracle, does a creative act sometimes involve waiting until the timing is right? Is timing part of that? And this is Jesus. So, you know, there was some maybe.
Well, and it is interesting that, As y'all have already pointed out, when you're talking about timing, that it's obvious in the story, Jesus didn't think this was the time. And sometimes when we're waiting for something to happen and we think we know what we're waiting for, a time comes and we're pushed into it when we're not ready for it, or it's not what we're expecting. And you got to go. And, you know, I never thought of it that way, but that's sort of what happened with Jesus. But what he was looking for the right time. But it got thrust on him, and you know,
right.
Don't really have a choice to pick your time.
And what happens here, I mean, it really is a creative act. You know, we say the miracle of the water to wine, but there's a creativity happening here. And I don't know if you guys have been following Elizabeth Gilbert, Big Magic. Have y'all read that book or listened to any of those podcasts? It's fantastic. You should. But
I
she
think
has
Nikki,
this whole.
Nikki mentioned it on a previous podcast, didn't she?
I think so.
We're both kind of fangirling about Elizabeth Gilbert. And she has a whole
book. But I haven't checked it out. Tell me about that.
Well, it's a book about creativity and the process of creativity. And what strikes me about this story about creativity is that, okay, let's call Jesus, maybe have a reach here, but call Jesus the artist for what happens might be some sort of artistry. That at first he says, wait a minute. There's an instinct or a knowledge or something that says, hang on. But then with the nudge, he is able to do something that's not even measurable to what they had expected. And it's not something, you know, they had planned, there's this amount of wine, we need this much for the party. And they came up lacking. And then he does this thing that's way more than what they had planned for. I wonder if that happens with creativity, with new things being made in our lives, in the world, all that kind of stuff. I've had moments where I had to say, it's just not right at this moment. But then when the moment is right, there's that trust, that stepping forward. And usually what happens is just this tremendous thing that I couldn't have even anticipated. And for me, as a person of Christian faith, I say God's in that. To get back to the story of Jesus, though, I just think it's amazing that Jesus at first takes the nudge, says, wait, says, hang on. But then there is the right timing. So how does timing and creativity work for you guys? How have y'all seen it work?
I really want to start singing Mumford and Sons, I Will Wait right now.
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I wish. I forgot my banjo, you know. If I had my banjo in here, definitely. But, yeah, I think that's an excellent question, Aaron, and it's something that I've thought about before, because so often the hardest part is to wait. You want to go ahead. Sometimes you want to just go ahead and just do it, you know, to quote Nike. But but that whole idea of waiting for a timing that's beyond you. And as you bring that up, I can't help but think about Jesus with Mary telling him, you know, kind of nudging him like we were talking about. It takes me back to the story of him in the temple from Luke's gospel when he gets separated from Mary and Joseph. And when they find him, he says, I've been about my father's business. And it was almost like he was in his father's timing, that he was trying to, that he wasn't operating on his parents' schedule of getting back home, but he was in the timing of in his father's house. And I can't help but wonder if maybe in that waiting, he was waiting for his heavenly father to nudge him forward. I hadn't even thought about that till now. But that waiting for him was maybe when he was getting the idea of how am I going to do this? Also, just the logistics of making that play out. So, yeah, that's a great question to wrestle with.
I love this line in here. Okay, Jesus says, fill the jars with water. They fill them up and draw some out. And the steward tasted the water that had become wine. This is verse 9. But he didn't know where it came from, though the servants knew. And it's why do I like that? I like that because I think if you want to know what's really going on at the church, don't talk to me. Talk to the custodian or the secretary.
Exactly.
They know what's going on.
Yes.
The steward doesn't have a clue how all this, but the servants, those we'd least expect in the Advent story, it's the shepherds. Here, it's the servants. They're the ones who know. They're the ones who have, I don't know, some insight into what this means, where this came from. I don't know. Am I off base on that? Granted, it's a small part of the story. I don't know. Every time I read it, that line sticks out at me. You know, the steward didn't know what happened, but the servants, they saw it all.
And what did they see? I think that's a huge thing. They got to see the action. I wonder how they would tell this story.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, what did they see? they heard Jesus tell them to fill these vats with water, and they did that. And when they lifted it out and the man started drinking it, it was wine. It doesn't say that they saw Jesus do hocus pocus, save a prayer, and make it change. But they know that somehow it changed because of Jesus. You know what I'm saying?
They saw a change happen. And also, this was Jesus' first miracle. So, you know, they're the ones making the reputation, maybe. They're the ones perhaps telling what happened later.
You know they had to tell.
You know they did.
Yeah, because it's, you know, you're right. I don't mean to insinuate they somehow were in cahoots with Jesus and saw that transition from water to wine. Maybe not, but what's clear to me in this story, at least, is on behalf of the chief steward there, he's bewildered. I don't know what's happened here, but the servants are sort of winking at one another. Yeah, 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 you know what's... You saw it too, kind of thing. You know that it's again. It's maybe I'm reading too much into it, but here once again, those that Jesus brings on the inside are those you know we would normally exclude. It's just the servants; they don't know what they're talking about. But here they know before others do that this was a manifestation of who Jesus was. This was Jesus' handiwork. It's always the servants.
I like that.
Which means
I do too.
Probably then that's the people we should hang out with. Maybe that's where we need to be. Maybe rather than rubbing elbows out in the dining room, maybe we need to be in the kitchen washing dishes. Maybe that's where the life is to be.
You see more of the story that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So say you're a servant and you've seen all this go down. Who is Jesus? What is the story that you're telling about this guy?
Invite him to your next party.
Yes.
Well, but I don't know, Aaron. When you said that, I thought, okay. Even though if I were a servant and I saw, maybe I didn't see this taking place, but I sort of know how this worked. I saw this Jesus fellow did this miracle. Even though I would have gained that insight, I think it would catapult me onto this journey of discovery. I got to know more. Mm-hmm. I need to know more about this person who not only had this, not just this magical power to turn water into wine. That's part of it, but also cared enough about the people here to provide for their needs here at this celebration, at this wedding time.
You said something that caught my ear there, Daniel, when you said provide for their needs, because we don't. The social justice guy in me says, is that really a need? A party? Wine at a party?
Right.
You know?
Right.
You know, providing for their needs. We think about feeding the hungry, clothing that kid.
Sure.
And here's Jesus as being extravagant just so people can feel good and celebrate.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and maybe that is a need, you know? Well, I was gonna say with Darian on our host, the last time she was here we mentioned her being a yoga instructor and you know, that maybe some of the people who are so uptight about yoga need it the most because they're so uptight. Maybe that's a need, is to celebrate and let it go. Maybe that's a genuine human need.
Well, certainly when there's need, we pay attention more, right? And maybe the shepherds needed to hear that message of hope and joy and possibility in Jesus' birth. And you know, maybe the servants were in a position of needing to see this this act of generosity and abundance.
And maybe we needed to hear from them.
Yeah.
Tell us, we think we know everything. Tell us what you know. Yeah.
I mean, this is not the first or the only time we see, well, maybe the first, but it's certainly not the only time that we see Jesus with this sense that it's overflowing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, cast your net on the other side of the boat, you know, and it just almost tips the boat over. There's so many mm-hmm. fish. You know, the loaves and the fishes feeding the crowd.
Yeah.
You know, and they had baskets full afterwards. It was just, you know, this sense that once it gets going, man, it's just, there's just tons. It's just everywhere. It's a wonderful image of abundance. I was at a church in Kentucky a few weeks ago, and they were serving communion that Sunday. And, you know, The communion table was gorgeous, and part of what struck me about it was how they had arranged it. They had they had a basket, giant basket sitting there, and it didn't have one or two loaves. It had like 15, 20 loaves, huge loaves, and they were piled up all over. I mean, it was overflowing with bread. And then on the other side, they had chalices and cups and pitchers. And I mean, it was just, and all of them were full. And it was this sense of abundance. Just by walking by the table, you got the sense, wow, this thing is just, it's going to, some of this is going to fall off. There's so much here. And it, you know, so as I've listened to us talk about, you know, this instance where Jesus takes scarcity and turns it into abundance, you know, I'm reminded of that abundance that we share in communion.
David, you just mentioned communion and how all that connects, right? Because the first miracle, he's turning water into wine. And the night before he's crucified, he's taking wine and saying, this is my blood for you. And it reminds me, this image of wine reminds me of a quote from Friedrich Buechner, actually a short description of wine from one of his books, and I'll note it there so you can look it up. Friedrich Buechner says, unfermented grape juice is a bland and pleasant drink, especially on a warm afternoon mixed half and half with ginger ale. Wine is a ghastly symbol of the lifeblood of Jesus Christ, especially when served in individual antiseptic thimble-sized glasses. Wine is booze, which means it's dangerous and drunk-making. It makes the timid brave and the reserved amorous. It loosens the tongue and breaks the ice, especially when served in a loving cup. Wine kills germs. As symbols go, it's a rather splendid one.
I've never read that quote of his.
I haven't either. That's wonderful, though.
Wishful thinking. A Seeker's ABC. I'll quote it on... I mean, I'll list it.
I don't have that book.
Yeah.
What is it? Put it in the show notes. If you can put that, I'd like to...
It's one of his big three, Whistling in the Dark, Peculiar Treasures, all those cute little things.
I've got those other two, but...
I think that maybe in Beyond Words also, or part of it, because it sounds familiar. And the only one I've got is Beyond Words, but I don't remember if it was under wine or communion. I'll have to check and see, but I'm pretty sure part of it's in there.
So if that's all that wine does, and that's Jesus' first miracle, that's pretty amazing.
Well, what a wonderful conversation and what a wonderful story to remind us of the abundance of God's love and grace. Sometimes I find myself maybe suspecting even that there's scarcity of those things, right? I mean, we walk through our days and maybe don't feel like there's enough love to go around or joy to go around or hope. And certainly in our world, it feels like sometimes we're at this party that it's running out of stuff, and we've got to maybe keep a little for ourselves. This story is a wonderful reminder of how the abundance of God's love and joy and peace and hope, that there is plenty for us all. And maybe if we really believe that, it affects how we live and how eager we are to share, how eager we are to give and to bring others in, because there's enough.
Amen.
Thank you all so much for this conversation. Hope you have a lovely evening, and I look forward to our next gathering.
Thank you.
Thank you. This was great.
Thanks a lot. Bye, everybody. Y'all have a great night.
Thanks, David.
Find more information about this podcast, as well as videos and teaching resources for this session, at faithelement.net. Subscribe to the Faith Element podcast on iTunes. Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.